are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, March 9th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Bernie's big upset. Michigan considered perhaps the biggest upset relative to polling in over 35 years. Also on the program, Trump's snake oil tour continues. Apparently big discounts on steaks and bottled water. Obama meets with potential Supreme Court nominees, despite the fact that Republicans have decided they're not going to do their jobs. Speaking of Republicans not doing their jobs, the unmitigated disaster that our states under Republican rule. Meanwhile, Democrats hold on to the Kentucky State House. Koch brothers attack electric vehicles. And a pro-gun poster mom is shot by her own toddler. Also on the program today, ladies and gentlemen, an excerpt of an interview I did for Ring of Fire Radio with Tim Canova. Who's Tim Canova? He is running against Debbie Wasserman Schultz in the primary for Florida's 23rd district for Congress. The guy is he's a fascinating guy in his own right, but he's also somebody who is running against somebody who I think just about everybody listening to this program can agree is a real problem for Democrats, for the left in general. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who her most recent, and talking to Tim Canova and getting the full hit list for Debbie Wasserman Schultz is rather disturbing. She really, really, really wants to protect payday lenders, among other sort of nefarious financial entities. But we actually have a segment. I guess this won't be on Ring of Fire. This is a third segment. I think maybe it's available on the Ring of Fire members podcast. But we're going to play a clip of the interview in a couple of minutes. And the rest of it you can get, I think, on the free Ring of Fire podcast. I'm not sure, but you can go to ROF pod. ROFpodcast.com? Or ROF pod, ROFpodcast.com. I'm not sure. We'll put a link to there after the show at majority.fm. It's ROFpodcast.com. In the meantime, speaking of pod, I have this on my mind. That's why. Today, Two Dope Boys and a Podcast is released, ladies and gentlemen. You can go to 2TWO DopeBoysPod.com. We have a link, of course, at majority.fm, or you can go right to subscribe what is it? Subscribe the numeral 2 DP.com.
DB.com.
All of this is available at majority.fm. But we really need you to go and subscribe to the show. Like we told you yesterday, hosted by, or co-hosted, I should say, by Michael and his buddy Phil. And you can see, you can head over to their website. We have an entirely different website for it. We've also got to get the logo on that splash page of majority.fm. You guys got to remind me about that. But we need you to go and subscribe to the show on iTunes. And what this does is it pushes it up the charts and it gives the opportunity to grow the audience. I mean, this is all part of what we did almost a year ago now with the Indiegogo campaign. I mean, you can see we have our new video set. We're in high definition now. We have camera switching. We're able to do these debates and we are expanding our offerings of podcasts as a way of basically supporting this show. I mean, a political podcast has a ceiling and will never attract the advertising base that it needs to support the entire show. But other non-specifically political podcasts, they don't have the same ceiling. And frankly, they don't have the same concern from advertisers that we're going to be on here calling for a revolution. I mean, there are many. And yesterday, actually, we had was a perfect example of, I mean, this wasn't their fault per se, but I had a call with, sometimes when you get these advertisers, they're pitching to you, you have a call with the advertiser. I thought it was going to be the company. I'm not going to say what the company was. I don't think they're necessarily a bad company. I don't really know for sure, but they're one of these peer-to-peer lending companies. And I thought I was talking to someone from the company because I had some questions about this. David Dayan has written some stuff on this sort of these basically tech companies that either function as a bank or they're in the sort of the shadow banking business. And so I got on the phone and I thought I was going to be talking to a representative from the company. I ended up talking to a representative from the ad company. And I said, you know, I got to tell you, I'm a little leery of this stuff. Well, we're happy to answer any questions. And I asked them about 4 or 5 questions. And the guy was just like, you know, sometimes it's not a right fit. Sometimes it's not a right fit. And I said, you know, I think we're probably right on that. I'm not going to, I'm not saying that the company was bad or good. I to be honest with you, I don't know, but I'm a little suspect of this. I asked them at one point, like, what is the regulatory agency that oversees this enterprise? And they're like, oh, well, they're underwritten by this bank. And I'm like, well, no, but that's not what I'm asking you. Yeah, you know, I really respect the fact that you ask these questions. No hard feelings. And we'll try and find something that matches up with you another time. And the amazing thing, Michael and I were talking about this. We've had phone calls with places that, like, you know, sell clothes. And they'll have their actual representatives. I've had more outreach from Harry's, frankly. And they're like, we want to tell you everything about this razor. And I'm like, you know, I can just use it. I don't need to know, like, the process of forging the steel. But meanwhile, when it comes to, like, hey, we've got this great new way of you can actually loan money and you can be like a major investment bank.
Just read the copy.
Yeah, just don't worry about it. It'll work out. Come on. What's the worst thing that could happen? So, but the point being that when you go to Dope Boys and subscribe, you can go directly to iTunes, just search the numeral 2 Dope Boys and a podcast. You will be supporting this show, and I think you're going to find a really interesting show about trends and brands and brands apologies. I mean, we'll talk more about the specifics of the show, but today, go and race and culture and sneakers. I saw that exhibit at the Brooklyn Museum, actually. But so go check it out. And you can go directly to subscribe, the numeral 2DB.com. And that will take you right to iTunes. Speaking of Harry's, yesterday, I don't know if I mentioned this. I hope I did. Maybe I didn't. Monday was Saul's third birthday. And I will give him a shofar, but we have somebody else whose birthday it was on March 8th. And I will give her a shofar as well in a moment. Oh, all right, here we go. Let's try this again. There you go. So Monday was Saul's third birthday, and for a birthday gift, I gave him a new Harry's razor set. Because the guy's three now, and no, I didn't do that. But it was a coincidence. Harry's is also turning three. And as you know, Saul likes to run around my house with the razor in his hand. Not the razor, but the handle. I'll let my three-year-old play with razors. When he's six, then that's when you give him a razor and you allow him to play around with that. But Harry's is, because they are turning three themselves, and I imagine they don't have a problem with, like, that Saul does with the pooping and the crying and the whining and all that. They are celebrating by offering the opportunity for you to try one of their expertly crafted five-blade German razors, a handle, and shave cream for just $10 with the offer code Majority Report. You guys know I love Harry's. I've got the best shave I've had in a long time. Harry's blades are super sharp and provide a close, comfortable shave. And it's really the only company out there that delivers it directly to your house that has both amazing quality and low prices. Why pay $32 for an 8-pack of blades when you can get them for half the price at harrys.com? Harry's starter set is an amazing deal. For just $15, you get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and three razor blades. But because it's their birthday, they'll give you $5 off your first order with the promo code Majority Report. Stop overpaying for a great shave. Go to harrys.com right now. That's Harry's, H-A-R-R-Y-S.com. Enter the code Majority Report at checkout. I mentioned it was Saul's birthday on Monday. Well, yesterday, and I just I missed this email. Listener Jennifer writes in, it's today, March 8th, my birthday. Can you give me a shofar? Because it could double as an International Women's Day shofar. It's frightening to me how dependent I am on hearing you guys talk about politics every day. It's a little bit nervous for us, too. It makes us a little bit nervous when you say something like that. Thank you for helping to keep me sane during this endless presidential campaign. Well, Jennifer, thanks for listening. Here is your shofar. Happy birthday. All right, before we get to this excerpt from Tim Canova interview, one thing I want to start off by talking about Bernie Sanders' big win yesterday, and there's a lot of implication to this, and we'll talk about it after the interview. We're just going to play a 10-minute clip or so. One thing that I had predicted yesterday in terms of the Democratic primary was that we would see coming out of Dearborn that Bernie Sanders probably, I thought, would lose with the Muslim population there. Something like 40% of the population is Arab. And my theory at the time yesterday was that I think most Democratic voters so far buy into the notion that Hillary Clinton is a stronger candidate in the general, just because that's been repeated over and over again. And I have dealt with that, what I think is I think is unsubstantiated by the numbers, but I also think is wrong. But it's certainly unsubstantiated to decide one way or another one is more electable than the other in the general. And I presumed that the voters would vote on that basis. What had not occurred to me is that they wouldn't vote for Bernie Sanders because he was Jewish. That never occurred to me because I'm a regressive. But it turns out that not only was that non-regressive theory that they would never vote for him because he's Jewish wrong, my theory was also wrong, like big time wrong. Dearborn, which is 40% Arab, voted overwhelmingly for Sanders over Hillary Clinton, 60 to 40%. And I don't know what's behind that any more than what was behind Bernie Sanders winning in Michigan, period. But we will talk about that because I think it's a big deal. I mean, we'll know more, obviously, a week from today. But the idea that Bernie Sanders could win in a state that he was predicted to lose by anywhere from like 22 points to 5 points. 538.com. Nate Silver's outfit said there was a 99% chance that Hillary Clinton was going to win Michigan. 99%. Now, I'm no math whiz, but that would mean that there was a 1% chance of Bernie Sanders winning. And that's what's probably because they don't go around saying it's 99.3%. Maybe there was even less than 1% chance. I mean, we're like in not quite lottery territory, but raffle territory. And the implications of that are huge because it suggests that whatever models people are using for a state like Michigan, which is a state like Illinois, which is a state like Ohio, which is a state like Pennsylvania, may be wrong. Which means that Bernie Sanders, for all we know, could be running neck and neck in these states. And that's huge.
He was also underpolling a bit. Not, it's nowhere near as dramatic and it's not as important, but in Kansas as well. So there's a bit of a trend behind it.
Yeah, I mean, it will remain to be seen, but we will talk about this afterwards. Now, of course, he lost Mississippi big, but here's the difference. Mississippi is in the South, and the African-American population, we have been talking about them as if they are a monolith, but there clearly is a difference in the perception of Bernie Sanders amongst African-Americans in the South versus, at the very least, African-Americans in Michigan. And so we will see if that carries over. But in the meantime, let's talk about something that is, I think, sort of shockingly not divisive. And that is that I, despite the fact that I know people in our audience are Clinton supporters and are Bernie Sanders supporters, and then, of course, we have that guy, Doug, who is a Trump supporter. But I think everyone can agree. I mean, I would be shocked if we had a Debbie Wasserman Schultz supporter. Let's put it that way. So here is a clip of an interview I did for Ring of Fire Radio. It's going to be playing this weekend on Ring of Fire with Tim Canova. I think in the interview we get to his background. He is an attorney. He is a, I think in this segment, we talk about him being a law professor, because it's sort of fascinating to me that we're seeing some of the most aggressive challenges to Democratic establishment figures from law professors. And I don't know. There's an ebb and flow. Who knows what's behind that? But Canova worked for Tsongas years and years ago, and we had talked about that a little bit. I think in the first two segments of the interview. But here is that third segment where I interview Tim Canova, who is running against Debbie Wasserman Schultz. His website is Tim Canova, CANOVA.com. And I think you're going to want to visit it and support him in some fashion, because Debbie Wasserman Schultz is a disaster in a myriad of ways. All right, here's that clip. We'll be back after this.
Sense of, like, you know, what has inspired you to enter politics? I mean, I know a long time ago, earlier in your career, you had worked as a legislative aide for Paul Tsongas, from who was the congressman from Lowell, and then became the senator of Massachusetts and ran for the presidency in '92. Give me a sense of, like, because you're not the first law professor. There seems to be a small but growing contingent of law professors who are representing many of the same issue sets that you are, right? I mean, Elizabeth Warren entered into politics as someone who was very much interested in what was happening with the middle class, particularly as it was around bankruptcy. Zephyr Teachout, now running for the 19th District in New York, who had challenged Governor Cuomo, very much interested, particularly in the issue of things like antitrust, but also money in politics. I mean, what's going on here?
And I would add Jamie Raskin as well in Maryland, who's a law professor at American University and has spent his career, his whole life, really, working for campaign finance reform and clean elections and taking the corruption out of our political system. It's interesting in that just a few years ago, many of the lawyers and law professors who were going into politics and running for Congress were former prosecutors. And now you look at the group that you're beginning to describe, and we're not former prosecutors. It's really progressive folks who want to see the party, you could say, return to its progressive roots. And I think that's obviously a good trend, that this is where the party is heading and this is where the grassroots and the activists are heading. You know, I haven't run for a political office before, but I've worked on a number of campaigns over the years, and for congressional candidates, for Senate candidates, for presidential candidates. So I've done a lot of the door knocking and the phone banking and things like that that other volunteers are doing for us now in our campaign. And I've also spearheaded some grassroots movements. I had been a law professor at New Mexico, University of New Mexico, and I worked on the grassroots movement that helped overturn felony disenfranchisement in New Mexico in early 2001. And that's a big problem here in the state of Florida. Because of the drug war and because of the state's felon disenfranchisement law, an enormous part of the population, and it really always falls, unfortunately, disproportionately on communities of color, on African-American, Hispanics, and Native American folks, and mostly young men, barred for life from voting. It's a blemish on our democracy. It has to change. And I just mentioned that as one of this list of, you could say, campaigns and political activism that I've worked on. So I never thought I was going to run for political office. It's not something that even occurred to me. And it was the Trans-Pacific Partnership last summer. I got involved with the Citizens Trade Campaign here in South Florida, lobbying against the TPP. And I've taught international trade law for many of the past 20 years and had very detailed criticisms of the TPP. And I tried to contact my local congresswoman's office, Debbie Wasserman Schultz's office, and I was directed to send an email to one of her legislative aides, which I did, and never heard a word back, and went through the same thing a couple of weeks later. And this is a pattern that it became very clear, not just to me, but to folks who have been active in South Florida much, much longer than me. People, like I said, involved in the Citizens Trade Campaign, that if you've got, you know, if you're a political action committee giving big checks to Wasserman Schultz, you'll get your phone calls returned, you'll get access, right. and apparently she'll vote along your interests. So on the TPP, between 2012 and 2014, just a two-year period, She accepted over $330,000 from groups who were favoring the TPP. And, you know, the organized labor, the environmentalists, the groups opposed to the TPP, who don't have much money to begin with, she took only $23,000 from those groups. And, you know, when it came down to voting on this issue, she voted to fast-track the TPP. She didn't even return calls. She treated people who were protesting like, not the way constituents should be treated. She actually gave folks no alternative but to protest, unfortunately.
Does it? I mean, I'm just curious. I mean, and maybe I'm just projecting on this, right? I mean, that this idea of, you know, we're seeing more sort of genuine, very aggressive progressives come out of just, you know, as from law professors. And I don't know. I noticed, I think it was today or yesterday, that students in Boston public schools were going out, they were marching, and they were going to protest because of school cuts. And I remembered my time as a high schooler in Massachusetts, where we had massive cuts. I think it was because of Proposition, it was either 13 or 3. I get confused. It was the model out of California, which was one of the 13 or 3, and then it came to Massachusetts. And which really cut funding for schools. And I thought, you know, the idea of protesting that as a high school kid at that time, for whatever reason, it just wasn't in the air. I didn't know anybody who would protest anything. And we all felt this was wrong, but it just never occurred to us. And I wonder if we've seen over the past 4 or 5 years, and I know that you were involved in Occupy Los Angeles a little bit, at least in terms of sort of providing some resources and in teaching people about the Fed. I wonder if, you know, people, if we are inspired by the stories we read outside of ourselves, and if you do look at people like, I don't know, like Elizabeth Warren and Zephyr Teachout and say, oh, I'm a law professor, I've been involved in politics, I should run.
Yeah, I think there is a little bit of that. I'll say I see more activism happening now in the past few years, and that's a sign of the times. There's a lot of frustration. You know, people are really fed up. They don't see the system changing. They see the two parties, unfortunately, acting very much alike on some very key issues, bread and butter issues of concern to them. And I can rattle off a bunch of issues where I agree with Debbie Wasserman Schultz on women's reproductive rights, on same-sex marriage, on pay equity. But, you know, fine. That's the way she tries to portray herself as a progressive. But being a progressive goes way beyond that. And, you know, it means that there should be jobs, not just for the elite, but for everybody. There should be a minimum sort of kind of living standard that hardworking families are not going to fall through the cracks. You know, what I've been saying is it's not progressive if it's not progress for all. Now, for your question in particular about have I been motivated by the example of some of these professors, yes. You know, I see Jamie Raskin fighting the good fight and Zephyr Teachout. It certainly made me think, well, you know, well, let me back up and say when the TPP occurred, the fast track vote, I was also endorsing Bernie Sanders. I had worked on an advisory committee that Senator Sanders set up on the Federal Reserve in 2011. So I was an early supporter of his. And to see his movement gaining momentum and the idea that perhaps, just perhaps, he could get elected president, but he's going to have to work with a Congress filled with corporate Democrats like Debbie Wasserman Schultz. To me, that was unacceptable. And you see this guy who's in his 70s, who's putting it all on the line. And it made me feel that the least I could do is to try to step up and help at the local level. And I think you see a lot of that happening around the country. Folks who are running for Congress who never thought they'd run for an office like that, who want to be part of a Bernie Congress, want to be part of a political revolution, perhaps that we could have a new deal, a different kind of a deal than we've had for the past. It's now going on 40 years when you look at the trends of income inequality. It's been a disaster for four decades for the middle class, for Main Street, and for the poor in this country.
Well, Tim Canova, I wish you good luck on your race there. And, you know, it's interesting dynamic because when you take out that calculation that a Republican could very well take this seat, when that notion is out of contention, then it really does become, you know, what is that candidate delivering? It's no longer about the fear that Republicans will take that seat. It really just gets down to, is that candidate delivering what should be delivered from a fairly safe blue, if you will, seat? And it's quite clear, I think, you know, to progressives across the country, you know, who have a huge interest in Debbie Wasserman Schultz just being nowhere near, frankly, the DNC or in Congress with any type of sort of broad national authority, even if it's just sort of in, you know, even if it's just nominal. You know, I think there's a lot of people out there who are going to support your campaign, I would imagine, but,
Tim Canova. And it is happening, Tim. I would encourage your listeners, to go to timcanova.com, check out our website, our issue statements. If they can donate a little amount online, you know, these donations are small, but they're adding up. It really is a grassroots type of a campaign. The Huffington Post looked at our race and said that this race that we're running in Florida's 23rd will reveal more about the future of the Democratic Party than any other race in the country this year, precisely because it pits progressive values against a corporate-dominated machine. And as you said, it's not as if voting against the incumbent, the Democratic incumbent, will somehow give some kind of aid or comfort to a Republican running in this district. So, you know, the stakes are very high, but they're also very clear. There's a big contrast between the kind of politics that we're running with this grassroots campaign where we won't owe anything to any corporate interests and the kind of politics that Wasserman Schultz represents, which, you know, just it hasn't been good for the party, but it also hasn't been good for this country.
Thanks, Tim. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Sam.
So that's Tim Canova. If you want to hear the rest of that interview, head over to ringoffireradio.com, and you can check it out. I think the show is posted by the end of the week. What was interesting was that Canova basically found his way to run for office on trade, and trade definitely appears to be a very prominent and probably, look, it shouldn't be surprising on some level, but there is obviously a huge sensitivity to trade issues when you get to states like Michigan, when you get to states like Ohio, because these are big, in many respects, post-manufacturing states. And but I think people were surprised as to just how, and again, we don't know for sure what happened last night, but let's break down some numbers in terms of Sanders and Clinton. We'll get to the Republican race, but basically the long and short of it is Marco Rubio is toast. People are deluding themselves that Kasich might make a run at Trump, but maybe we'll see Kasich Cruz. It doesn't really matter, I don't think, at this point. But the real important thing is that I think we're, according to Trump, we're all getting free bottled water and steaks.
The steaks are $50.
Well, it's close to free. So let me just quote this from Nate Silver. This was last night at 9:30 p.m., about an hour and a half before Michigan was called for Sanders. If Sanders winds up winning in Michigan, in fact, it will count among the greatest polling errors in primary history. Or there's another way of saying this, right? It's an underdog comeback. Clinton led by 21.3 percentage points in our final Michigan polling average. Previously, the candidate with the largest lead to lose a state in our database, well-polled primaries and caucuses, Walter Mondale, led New Hampshire by 17.1 percentage points, but lost to Gary Hart in 1984. Apparently, late-breaking voters, people who made up their mind to vote in the past week or two, went pretty strongly for Bernie Sanders. And we also know that Clinton won in the absentee ballots that were already put in. which suggests that that number could have been, which suggests that basically the trend was towards Sanders as the race got closer. And this is relevant for a number of reasons. One, it suggests, and there was reports that I guess the UAW officials, sort of through private channels, were pretty pissed off at Clinton's claim that Sanders did not support the auto bailout. And it's hard to know whether or not they were able to reach and mobilize their voters. It's hard to know whether or not UAW members were just like, you got to be kidding me. But that clearly did not work. It also clearly did not work to say that Sanders was interrupting Clinton or interrupting her interruption. Those things did not work. People who care about trade, there was a really interesting breakdown. And, you know, again, let me just say this. We're not going to know until Ohio happens, really, as to, you know, whether or not this was just a bad, for some reason, the people couldn't take polls in Michigan, or whether or not there is a real movement towards Sanders from these Rust Belt voters. And I predicted last night that on Twitter, probably around 9:30, that if Sanders wins this, he's going to change the narrative of the race. And you can already see it. If he wins Ohio, it's really going to change the narrative of the race. Because after Ohio, it's going to be pretty clear that Donald Trump is going to be the nominee. And every scenario which has Donald Trump winning in the general election, which I think is very far-fetched against either Democrat, frankly, but every scenario is going to be about him winning Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, maybe Illinois, and rewriting the map, maybe upstate New York, and thereby New York, perhaps. And that's going to be the narrative. Whether or not that's true or not, I don't know that he could do that. But that's going to be the narrative. If that is seen as Donald Trump's strength, that is going to implicate the electability argument when you're talking about Sanders and Clinton. Because there are a lot of Democrats. I mean, for sure, there's a lot of Democrats who say, you know, who like Clinton for any number of reasons, ranging from she's the most experienced or has the most experience with what being president is about, to just her record in general, to the fact that she would be the first woman president, to just having a pre-existing sort of relationship in the way that people have with politicians. But in terms of electability, and you hear a lot of people say, I like Sanders, I like his positions, but we have to beat the Republican nominee. If that argument swings in favor of Sanders, and again, I've said this many times before, there's no data to suggest that Clinton is stronger than Sanders. Or frankly, that Sanders is really that much stronger than Clinton. Everything is speculative. But I think the argument then becomes that Sanders is a bigger firewall to any path that Donald Trump might have to the presidency. Sanders is the one who can stand in between Donald Trump and winning Ohio, winning Michigan, winning Illinois. That's how the argument goes. And that's what the narrative is going. That's going to be a big shift if what happened in Michigan carries over to Ohio. We just don't know. I mean, right now, Sanders is down 30 points in Ohio. He's also down 30 points in Florida, maybe 25, at least according to the CNN poll. But this notion, listen to this this stat. This is exit polls from CNN. Again, take this with a grain of salt. 6 in 10 Michigan Democrat primary voters said international trade takes away U.S. jobs. Sanders won them by 20 points. So 60% of Michigan Democrats said that are suspicious of international trade. And put aside whether or not it does or does not. That's their perception of trade. So when they look at a deal like TPP, they're suspect of it. When they look at fast track, they're suspect of it. On the Republican side, 55% of primary voters said trade takes away from U.S. jobs. So almost the identical number. In the context of exit polling, 5-point swings, not that dramatic. And Trump won 20 points more than Ted Cruz on that. He won 45% of that group. Sanders won 60% of that group. So that's a big issue in a state like Michigan. And there's every reason to believe that's going to be the same issue in Ohio or in Pennsylvania or in Illinois. And a stat like that is going to, we're going to hear statistics like that a lot more over the next 5 or 6 days. Maybe tonight there's a debate, right? We're going to hear this tonight during the debate. Now, I've said on this program for a long time that Sanders ought to be forcing Clinton to make pledges on things, to challenge them. Very sort of low-end politicking. Tonight during that debate, he should say, Secretary of State Clinton, will you take a pledge right now to veto the TPP or the TTIP? Because the TPP, remember now, the language can't change. She can say, as it's written now, I don't like it. But the language is not going to change because it has been ratified by the countries. It needs to be ratified by their specific legislature, but all the negotiators have signed off on the language. If they change the language in any way, then it has to go back into negotiations. The whole thing's a disaster. So the language is set in stone. And now it's basically an up or down vote. He's got to make her raise her right hand and say, I promise to veto this. I promise that if somehow it gets passed during a lame duck session, I will veto it. And I will encourage every Democratic lawmaker to veto it. He's got to make her take this pledge, because if she doesn't, this is the week to do it. I mean, tonight's really the night to do it. Because if he doesn't do that, well, I'm not saying there's going to be implications if he doesn't do it, but if he's going to do it, tonight's the night to do it. Because if she doesn't take that pledge, it's going to hurt her in Ohio. This is the way you make that pointed contrast. And here's the point. Here's the other, aspect of this. She's going to have to make that pledge anyways. Because if she does go up against Trump, she should be very concerned that Donald Trump is going to get to the left of her on this issue. One third of Democratic voters, or I should say voters in the Democratic primary, said Clinton is too pro-business. Sanders won more than 4 in 5 of them. So almost all of them. He won. Some other numbers to keep in mind. Clinton won Democrats by, I think, 15 to 19 points. Sanders won independents by, I think, double that. It's an open primary. Ohio is an open primary. Illinois, open primary. Florida is the only closed primary that we're going to see next Tuesday. Now, those independents, I think they make up about 25% of the Michigan population. They probably vote Democratic for the most part, in presidential elections. I mean, just generically speaking, even if you call yourself an independent, you look at your voting record, you'll see that you tend to vote for one party over the other. Nevertheless, that means that Sanders has the ability to draw people who perceive themselves as independents. He, of course, did good with young people, as has been, but he also did well with people up to the age of 40. He won that cohort by double digits. He lost African-American voters by a 2-to-1 margin to Hillary, but that's actually significantly better than he did in the South. And that suggests that African-Americans in northern states just more amenable to Sanders than they are in the South, or are less attached to Clinton, however you want to perceive that. There was some reports, this is anecdotal, that there were Democrats who felt like Clinton's already got it wrapped up. I'm going to cross over because it's an open primary and vote for Kasich to stop Donald Trump. I find it very hard to believe that there was a significant number of people who are doing that. I mean, we hear reporters talking about, they talked to people who said they were doing that. Those people are also the type of people who would talk about it. I mean, I don't know how many times, you know, how many times I've told people, like, I vote swapped in 2000. When you do stuff like that, you tend to talk about it more. When you vote that strategically, part of that strategy is get other people to do it. So you hear about it more. So I'm not convinced. And I guess maybe people, maybe someone has exit polling to show that there were specifically numbers. But so that's basically the wrap up of Michigan on the Democratic side. Mississippi, of course, Clinton walked away with it. But that's not a terrible surprise. And frankly, we're moving north now. So aside from Florida. You know, half of Florida is like just transplant, particularly on the Democrat side, from the north. So we've got California, we have Florida, we have Illinois, we have New York, we have New Jersey, we have Ohio, we have Pennsylvania. Huge number of delegates there. Huge number of delegates. And these aren't all taking place next Tuesday. Just Ohio and Illinois and Florida. But this is why you hear like, you know, Marcos on Daily Kos saying after the 15th, if there's no clear movement, we're going into general election mode. Well, it does not appear. I mean, unless Michigan was just a complete fluke, it does not appear that the Democratic Party is going to be moving into general election mode after next week.
Are the states for next week, are they open and are they winner-take-all?
They are not winner-take-all. And in fact, I'm not even sure that we have winner-take-all in the Democratic Party. I think just in the Republican. Ohio is almost as open as Michigan. So in other words, in Michigan, you can show up and you can vote for anybody. In Ohio, you show up and you say, I'm a registered Democrat. I'm going to vote for in the Republic. I want a Republican ballot. If you are challenged at that point by a poll worker, which probably happens very rarely, but if you are, you just have to fill out a form that says I'm going to do this, and boom, you're done. So it's for all intents and purposes is open, and the roadblock doesn't come until after you've expressed your desire to do it. So chances are that's not too much of a deterrent. Florida is closed. Illinois is open as well. So Clinton has a big lead in Illinois and in Ohio, but we'll see. All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Almost did it. Was 10 minutes late. Almost got it within 40 minutes. In the fun half, we've got, yes, more Ernie Bach Jr. We will play some of, and Well, I'll talk about the press conference that, that Trump had, and we'll talk about what's going on in Louisiana. Unbelievable disaster there. Bobby Jindal left that state just a disaster. And we're seeing it also in Oklahoma. We've seen it in Kansas. I know, and I will say this, if you're a libertarian, you want to call into the program, today's the day to do it. Call me and tell me about the Laffer curve. If you're a conservative, if you believe in conservative voodoo about cutting revenue to raise revenue, please call me and explain this to me.
Are you familiar with the freedom curve?
646-257-3920 is the number. Remember, this program relies on its members to exist. If you have the ability to support the show, please do. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. If you can't, but you want access to the extra material that we provide for members, then send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. May take us a couple of days to get back to you because I'm always behind on the emails, but send us an email. We'll work out something. We will not lock anybody out for lack of funds. But if you are one of those people who are fortunate enough to have the funds to support a program you listen to one, two, three, four, five times a week, I don't know. This week we're going to have six shows, right? With the debate, Republican debate tomorrow night. Then please join themajorityreport.com. Of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Buy the Majority Report blend. Give it as a gift. If you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is to buy it from our link at majorityreportkickback.com. And if you don't want to buy crap from Amazon, but you want the convenience of having this stuff shipped right to your door, jet.com, folks, they're still giving you 15% off your first purchase. They got a bunch of stuff there. That's also at majorityreportkickback.com. Going to take a quick break. Go and subscribe right now. Subscribe, number 2db.com. Subscribe, 2db.com. Support the show that way. Won't cost you anything. And you'll also have the opportunity to listen to a great new show. We'll be right back after this.